Welcome to Texas True Crime. I'm your host, Jessica, and I'm so glad that you're here with me. Last week, I really wanted to get an episode out to y'all, but it soon became clear to me that there just weren't enough hours in the day. I hosted Easter at our house last weekend, and there were about 20 people here. So between getting the house ready, cooking, and all the other stuff that goes into getting ready for a gathering at your home, I had to finally admit to myself Sunday evening after everyone had been here, we had had a wonderful meal that not only did I help prepare, but my sister-in-law, y'all, makes the best broccoli rice casserole ever. And our epic confetti egg or cascarones fight that we have every year, there's confetti all over my house and in my yard, and I had to clean up, which, don't get me wrong, I love every minute of it. And I am right in the middle of that confetti egg fight with my nieces and nephews and my daughters. Like, I love it. I'm one of the kids myself. But I had to admit to myself, I wasn't going to get an episode out to you guys as much as I would have liked to. There just weren't enough hours in the day. And I wasn't ready. But I hope if you do celebrate Easter that you had a lovely Easter, because mine was great. So I do not want it to sound like I was complaining, because it was lovely. But I also want to say, I'm giving y'all a heads up. April and May for a teacher are nutso. It's our like wind down to the school year, testing, wrapping things up, award ceremonies, not just for my kids in my class, but my own personal children. There's a lot. Plus, we just have a lot going on in our personal life. We have got people coming in from out of state, all over the place. So I'm going to get y'all episodes, but I'm just going to go ahead and tell you up front, because I want you to be aware. And I don't want to like keep having to tell you, sorry. I'm going to get y'all episodes, but they may not be on Tuesday. And lately, I haven't. I've been having to push it back to Tuesday evening or Wednesday. I'm going to get them to you, but they're not going to be on schedule for the rest of April and May. So I just wanted to put it out there and be upfront with all of y'all, because I think that's fair. I love the podcast. I love all of y'all, and I love doing it, but I'm a one-man band. And other podcasters, you know, the big guys, they've got research teams and people who type up their scripts and everything else. And it's just little old me, which I kind of like it that way. I'm not going to lie. Kind of a control freak. I want to be the one doing the editing and the one doing the research and the one typing up my script, because I know what I want to say to y'all, because it's not really a full-on script, because we all know I get off all my rants. But because it is just me, sometimes my family life or my work life gets in the way of getting to y'all. So I felt like it was only fair to go ahead and give you that heads up that they're coming, but it might be a little funky on the schedule. So without any more talk of all that mess, and I appreciate each and every one of you, let's start. This week, I have a doozy for you, and I can't get it in one episode, which is why I told you we were going to have more than one, and I'm going to get that second one out right away to you, but because you have been so patient. But it's not even going to be a two-parter like I had originally thought. There's going to need to be more. It's a doozy. And if you're not familiar with the Robert Durst case, be prepared to frequently ask yourself, what the hell did you just hear? Because I know as I was doing my research and reading, I frequently said, what the hell? I remember hearing about all the Robert Durst things, but I guess I just really didn't get in tune to it, because I know if I had realized what was going on, I'd have been glued to this. But the whole case spans over 40 years, y'all. And it's not going to start in Texas. So be patient with me, because we're going to start in New York. But to to get to the part that happens in Texas, I feel like I need to tell it to you in order. I don't really feel like this is a circle back around type deal. I'm going to have to go in the timeline. Robert Durst is one of those people that when you really start looking at him, he has a very checkered past, and there's a lot of questions that have gone unanswered about this man. And he was a nut. I'm sorry, no disrespect to anyone, but he was a nut. That's really all there is to say about it. He is scary. And I can see after all the research I've done, reading, watching documentaries, reading old newspaper articles, reading his ex-wife's journal, the excerpts that have been published, why his family, his friends, former employees, and some of the law enforcement who dealt with him openly admitted that they were terrified of this man. His brother hired full-time bodyguards for protection from Robert Durst himself. And our story starts in New York in the 1970s, but it crosses the United States. I mean, California all the way to New York, Texas in the middle, other places as well. Robert Durst was diabolical. And he seems, by all accounts, like a man with no conscience. And his only real care in the world was self-preservation. He even, and I don't know if it's true or not, but as an adult, he had a psychologist say that he was autistic, very high functioning, something that used to, in schools and in the autism spectrum, would be called Asperger's disease, which really, I said that wrong, not disease, Asperger's syndrome, but what used to really, which meant that you're very high functioning, but you just didn't display emotions or understand emotions like other people. But I don't think that Robert Durst was on the autism spectrum. I personally believe that he wanted to use that as an excuse because he was a psychopath, and it was just one more medical diagnosis that he could use to try to make an excuse to get out of trouble. And as we go along, you're going to see why I say that. Also, it's going to be pretty obvious the more we learn about him that he is a case of money can pretty much buy you whatever you want and can fix a lot for you. So, without further ado, let's get to it. Robert Durst was born on April 12th, 1943, to Seymour and Bernice Durst. Robert grew up in Scarsdale, New York, and he was the oldest of four siblings, Douglas, Tommy, and Wendy. In 1902, his grandfather, Joseph Durst, immigrated to the United States from Austria-Hungary with $3 pinned to the lapel of his suit jacket, and he ended up becoming a successful real estate manager and developer. In 1915, Joseph Durst founded the Durst Organization and cemented the family in the upper echelons of New York real estate. In fact, they are so cemented in those upper echelons, the Durst Organization currently has a net worth of $8.1 billion today. So it's no joke. You know, they're right up there, you know, in like the Rockefeller stratosphere. So these are people that are well-connected. They are people that have more money than God. And like I said, money can buy you pretty much whatever you want. So Robert's mother herself suffered from mental health issues. And in 1950, you know, getting help for suffering from mental health problems were, you know, treatment was not the same. The medication wasn't as good for you. Therapy wasn't as good. The services you did receive. I mean, like they did things like electroshock therapy. It was not what we have today. On top of that, mental health wasn't discussed like it is. And because they were a wealthy, prominent family, they probably really tried very hard to keep it under wraps. It was not a discussion that people were having. Well, when Robert was 7 years old, Bernice jumped off the roof of their house. And police and the fire department were called to try and help her down. But before they could get to her, she jumped. Seymour, Bernice's doctor and Bernice's father, had been in the living room of their home discussing Bernice's treatment. So, and that's the thing. Luckily for Bernice, she did have a support system. But like I said, they still didn't, they just weren't equipped in the 1950s to really offer good help. And so Robert, as a sweet little boy at this point, had gone to check on his mother. And when he found out that she was not in her bed like they thought she was, they thought she was sleeping. And I'm guessing that they had probably given her some kind of medication to help her sleep because all three men thought she was sleeping. Robert went in to check on her to see if she was comfortable. And when she wasn't there, he discovered that she had climbed up on top of the roof. So Robert ran. And while the men were downstairs discussing the treatment and what they were going to do to try to help Bernice, Robert ran into the living room to tell them that Bernice was not sleeping. She was not in bed. She had climbed up onto the roof of their second story. Now, they did not try to hide the fact that Bernice was out there. They called the fire department. They called the ambulance. They called the police. And the fire department had actually arrived by this time. One of the firemen had gotten their ladder truck. He had put it up against the house and was midway up asking Bernice to please wait on him so he could come up to get her and bring her down. He said, please just hold on. Let me come to you. And she dived off the roof of the house. 7-year-old Robert was standing in the driveway with his father and grandfather when his mother died. So you can imagine what this does to a child who witnesses such a traumatizing, horrific event. Now, the family also would forever refer to it as a tragic accident, claiming that Bernice was disoriented from her asthma medication. So even though they were trying to seek help for her, they also didn't want to talk about it. And according to everything I've read, Bernice suffered from depression and anxiety. And she just, the doctors were not able to help her sufficiently. Well, obviously, like I said, witnessing his mother's death was very traumatizing for Robert, and he himself spent quite a bit of time in therapy. The doctor's notes on Robert Durst as a child are very unsettling. And according to a letter from Robert's doctor to his pediatrician, he wrote that it was his opinion that Robert's hostility towards his father and his younger brother, Douglas. Now, Robert blamed his father for his mother's death. He believed that Seymour Durst could have done more for his wife, that there should have been something else that he could have done to help his wife. So after that, they were never close, father and son. But Robert also, even though they weren't close, he sought his father's approval in everything. Back to the notes. The doctor said that Robert's hostility towards his father and his younger brother, Douglas, was of such intensity that it might constitute a destructive psychodynamic force sufficient to produce a personality decomposition and possibly even schizophrenia. The doctor wrote this when Robert Durst was 10 years old, so he had already been in therapy for 3 years. So to say that about a child so young, that's very unsettling. And also really kind of foreshadows what Robert is going to be like in the future. Robert went to Scarsdale High School, but he wasn't very popular. His classmates considered him a loner and somewhat of an outcast, and he really didn't try to do anything but be an outsider. He really thought that he was above the other kids in his class. He thought he was better than they were, and he didn't want to mess with them, really. When Robert graduated, he went to Lehigh University, and he got a degree in economics. He then went on to UCLA and enrolled in a doctoral program where he met his lifelong best friend, Susan Berman. Susan Berman was the daughter of mobster Davey Berman, who worked for Bugsy Siegel and took over operations at the Flamingo Hotel in Las Vegas after Siegel's murder in 1947. And Susan Berman really played up to this image of a mobster's daughter. She wanted everyone to know about it. She always talked about it. And where Robert was quiet and shy, Susan was loud and brash. They bonded over the fact that their parents died when they were both very young. When Susan was 12, her father died unexpectedly on the operating table, and by all accounts, he probably died of a heart attack, but Susan always, always put it out there that it was a very mysterious death on the operating table. So she really perpetuated that mobster lifestyle. And then a year later, when Susan was 13, her mother died by suicide. But again, she really played up that she thought that her mother had been murdered. It was staged to look like a suicide, that she really had not taken those sleeping pills, that someone else had done that to her. Her mother was a showgirl in Las Vegas. So Susan really played up to all of that mystique of that time frame when the mob really was big in Vegas. But she also really was paranoid that her father's past was still following her. So they bonded over this, losing their parents at very young ages. Susan herself said that she felt very bereft. She didn't have anyone. She didn't have that grounding force that a family gives you. And so when she and Robert met, she took him under her wing and considered him the brother she never had. They were never romantically linked. It was always very much a family type relationship. And they were so close that Robert gave Susan away when she got married. Robert dropped out of UCLA before he graduated, and he moved back to New York in 1969. But he did not tell his family that he dropped out. He let them all believe that he had graduated and that he did receive that doctoral degree because, yet again, he wanted his father's approval. And so he did not let his family know that he was not successful in that doctorate program. But Robert also wasn't interested in the family business. What he really wanted to do was open a health food store. But he moved back to New York and he was really just doing kind of a mid-level job. He was collecting rents from all of the Durst Organization buildings that they owned. He was overseeing the properties, things like that. But Kathy McCormick was living in one of those Durst buildings. She was the youngest of five children. Her father passed away also when she was fairly young of cancer, and her mother, Ann, raised all five children pretty much on her own. She was from a working class family in Long Island, and she moved to Manhattan when she was just 19. She worked several jobs, but her main job was as a dental hygienist. And like I said, she lived in one of the Durst buildings. She was renting an apartment when Robert came by one morning to collect her rent. Well, Robert and Kathy was a beauty by all accounts. In fact, at one point she had even done a little modeling. She was a beauty. She was smart. She was dynamic. She had a big personality. And Robert was instantly smitten with her. And when he was picking up the rent, he asked her out on a date. Well, Kathy, of course, here she is, this working class girl, working several jobs, trying to make ends meet so she can live in Manhattan. And here is the heir to the Durst fortune asking her on a date. Robert wooed her at first. He was quite a bit older. He was 28. But Kathy thought that he was quiet and sensitive. She thought he was so different from all the other boys that she had known. He was grown. He was sophisticated. And she told her friends that she felt like Cinderella when she first met. I mean, after all, Robert was taking her to fancy dinners and to big social gatherings, and she was getting to dress up. He was incredibly wealthy. This was a lifestyle that she was not accustomed to. And Kathy was into it, which, can you blame her? I mean, how could you not be into being wined and dined and taken to all the finest places, right? So they'd only had two dates when Robert asked Kathy to move to Vermont with him and help him open and run his health food store. Well, Kathy jumped on it. She was like, yes, I will do this. But her mother, Anne, was not thrilled when she told her mother what she planned to do. And Anne told her, Catholic girls do not cohabitate. They get married. So you can see what Anne thought about all this. But she knew Kathy wouldn't listen. She was headstrong, and she was ready to go. And at first, Kathy and Robert's relationship was like a fairy tale. The couple worked together at the health food store, and then they would take long drives in the country, and they would go on picnics. They took long walks through the woods. They traveled all over the world. They went to the Caribbean. They went to Europe, to South America, and to Asia. Robert had no interest in the family business. He let everyone know it. He was content to stay in Vermont with Kathy and run the health food store. Sometimes they would take off and drive in Robert's VW van, and they would go on these long road trips, and they would sleep in the back of the van. But Kathy thought it was romantic because it was all about them. And Robert was. He was endearing, and he was thoughtful, and he did these wonderful things for her. But as the oldest son of the Durst family, Robert was expected to come back to New York and work for the family business, and not just in a mid-level job.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
The couple married in 1973 in a very low-key civil ceremony in front of the Justice of the Peace. The only two guests at the wedding were Seymour Durst and Kathy's mother, Anne McCormick. It was so low-key that when they all went out to dinner after the wedding, even though Anne was sitting there with people who at that time were worth $500 million, she still had to pay for her own meal after the wedding. So Seymour didn't even chip in and pay for their dinner. It was just four of them. Wasn't even like they had a big to-do. But even then, not paying. And this is, as you're going to see, it's been going to become a deal. Robert also, who at first starts out very generous with his money, becomes very tight, very cheap, very controlling of all of his money. So, but even though the wedding was not much, and Kathy didn't seem to mind that, which Anne was, you know, she felt like it was a little odd, but Kathy was all for it, so no one said anything. But Kathy and Robert did take a six-month-long honeymoon driving all over the United States. But here we go. We're about to see Robert's cheap side, because Robert wrote all of it off as a business expense, saying that he was checking on Durst properties, even though the Dursts didn't own properties anywhere they visited. All of their properties were in New York. When the honeymoon was over, they moved back to New York, and Robert was very bitter about going back to New York. Like I said, he wasn't interested in the family business. He didn't want to be a part of the family business. He let them all know he wasn't interested in it. But he went back like the dutiful son that he was. And at this point, Kathy and Robert's marriage was still okay. Robert was very generous with friends. And in the beginning, he didn't really show that cheapskate side until later on. And because of his wealth, they could get into any club they wanted. They went to all the hot spots at the time. And where in most fashion, because they were, you know, Studio 54, Xenon, all the places in the 70s and the early 80s that were the it places to be. Because of his wealth, they were able to just walk right in. Those velvet ropes were lifted. And Kathy and her friends thought this was so much fun. And Susan Berman joined them also. And why wouldn't they find it fun? They were in their early 20s. They were having a great time. They were young. It was what you do, right? So at that point, the marriage was still fun. But unfortunately, that fun didn't last very long. Kathy had decided to become a nurse. So she'd enrolled in nursing school. And that was actually where she met some very close friends. And we are going to talk about them more later on, because they are these friends that she met in nursing school and became her core group of friends. They're who pushed right alongside her family, but even sometimes they pushed more for the investigation into her disappearance. They were convinced that Robert did something to her, and these ladies really did try to get justice for her. But after Kathy graduated from nursing school, she decided that she wanted to keep going. She wanted to pursue a medical degree. So she wanted to be a pediatrician. So she enrolled in the Albert Einstein School of Medicine in the Bronx and began taking classes. Now, 3 years into their marriage, things were not great anymore. Kathy found some Polaroid pictures stuck inside different books that were in a bookshelf in their penthouse apartment at their home in New York. And it was very random Polaroids. It was pictures of the books organized on the shelves, pictures of the inside of their medicine cabinet, pictures of their bedroom. But they were random. They didn't make any sense. And Kathy confronted Robert about them. And he said he was having an affair. And he took those pictures because when he brought this woman to their home, he would move everything around to make it appear like he wasn't married. And so then, after she left, he could get those pictures out and look at them to help him know where to place everything back where it belonged. So that right there was a slap in Kathy's face. Not only was Robert having an affair, but he was bringing this woman to their house, to their home. And then on top of that, this woman was Prudence Farrow, Mia Farrow's sister. Now, if you aren't familiar with who Mia Farrow is, she was the it girl in the 60s, 70s, and even the 80s. She was the star of Rosemary's Baby. She was married to Woody Allen. She was everywhere. So this is the sister of a very high-profile star. And then on top of it, Prudence Farrow was the inspiration for a Beatles song, y'all. The song Dear Prudence was written about Prudence Farrow. Same. If you're not familiar with the song, get on YouTube or Spotify, look it up. It's a great song. But can you imagine being the woman who was the inspiration for a Beatles song, for crying out loud? And Kathy finds out that this is who her husband's having an affair with? I mean, she was beside herself. She was devastated. And can you blame her? She thought she had this fairy tale life, and it's falling apart around her. And Robert just doesn't care. He's like, yeah, we're having this affair. I brought her here. And he has no remorse about it at all. And then to make matters worse, Prudence would call Kathy at her home and say, I love Robert and he loves me. You need to let him go. You need to give him a divorce so that we can be together. It was awful. Kathy was depressed. She was humiliated. She didn't know what to do, but because she was determined to make her marriage work, she didn't want to divorce Robert. And her friends and her family said, get out, get out. But she didn't. She was determined. She's going to stick it out. But even though Kathy was determined to try to make things work, things continued to deteriorate. Talk of domestic violence started to filter through their group of friends and their acquaintances. The neighbors reported a time when Kathy was outside their window on their balcony. She was so scared of Robert that she had crawled out of the window on their balcony and crawled over to their balcony and was screaming and crying and banging on their window to let her in. She was so scared. She was trying to escape from Robert, and that's how she got out, y'all. That's desperation right there. So how bad must it have been in that penthouse apartment? Now, the couple let her in, and they let Kathy stay with them until she calmed down, and they offered to let her stay with them. They urged her to call the police, but Kathy refused. She composed herself, went back home to her own apartment, to Robert. But then things only continued to get worse. Now, Robert had told Kathy from the get-go, he did not want children. He wasn't interested in being a father. He did not want kids. It was not something he was interested in at all. And so the couple did. They took birth control. Kathy had a diaphragm to take those precautions so she wouldn't get pregnant. But in 1976, she did become pregnant. I mean, it happens. We all know this. Birth control is not 100% foolproof. Well, Robert was furious with her. He demanded to know how she had become pregnant when she was on birth control. And he was mad. He was mad at her. But Kathy was excited. She was hoping that maybe Robert would change his mind, that they were going to have a baby together. But he didn't change his mind. Instead, he told Kathy that she had to get an abortion. And if she was not going to get an abortion, he was going to cut her off, divorce her, and cut her off without a penny. So Kathy stayed with him and she got an abortion. Now, she also at this time learned that Robert was embezzling money from his father's company. He was picking up those rent checks he was supposed to from those properties that he was checking, but instead of depositing them into the Durst organization accounts, he was depositing them into his own personal accounts. Kathy, at this point, fell into a very deep depression, but still refused to leave Robert. And she was miserable. But things started to turn around. Her mother started to get more hope because the couple bought a cottage on Lake Truesdale in South Salem. This was in upstate New York. And they said it was going to be their weekend retreat. Kathy hoped that this was going to revive their marriage because it would be hopefully like their old times in Vermont. And for a little while, it did get a little bit better. But not for long. Kathy called her sister in 1979 and said that she and Robert had had a fight and that he had hit her so hard that he knocked her to the ground. But Kathy continued to tolerate the abuse. There was another time they were going to a function and Robert told Kathy how she should speak, how she should dress, what she should do, and Kathy questioned him. So he turned around and poured a bucket of water on her. Again, Kathy took the abuse. She was convinced that she was going to be able to make it work and they were somehow going to get back to those early golden days. But those of us now that are familiar with domestic violence, that doesn't happen. That honeymoon phase only lasts and then things don't get better. That's what it is. Plus, Kathy signed a prenuptial agreement when she and Robert got married. And it said that if she was the one who filed for divorce, then she would get nothing. And she was close at this point to finishing medical school. So she really, and even her friends said, you know, like, just stick it out. You don't have that long. Get your medical school paid for. Then you can get a job and you can support yourself. So she really was trying to make the best of it. But by 1980, Kathy had started taking tranquilizers prescribed by her doctor to deal with the stress of living with Robert. Besides being physically abusive, he was also mentally abusive. He questioned every purchase she made. He refused to give her any money and refused to do things like just simple maintenance on their house and on her car. Her air conditioner went out in her car that she drove every day to school. It would have cost $200. Now, $200 is a lot of money in 1980, but not to Robert Durst. He's a millionaire hundreds of times over, but he wouldn't do it. It was a way to control her. And at one point, the abuse got so bad that Kathy ended up in the hospital. But again, she refused to press charges, even when the hospital staff said, "Get out while you can." Kathy's family was worried about her, and they could see that she was slowly unraveling. She called her friends and family on a regular basis in the middle of the night, during the day, all the time, crying and upset, detailing the abuse that she had suffered from Robert that day, that afternoon, that night. And she would talk to them for hours. It was harrowing. Her family, her friends, they didn't know what to do. They urged her to leave him, but she wouldn't. She wasn't ready to let it go. She was hoping she could finish her medical school. She was just months out. But by 1982, Robert had completely cut her off. She was borrowing money from friends. She was barely scraping by. And she was married to one of the richest men in New York. It was absurd. Kathy also started drinking and doing drugs to cope with the situation. Cocaine was her drug of choice, and she was doing 2 to 3 grams of cocaine a week. To make matters worse, because of the stress, because of the drinking, because of the drugs, her grades were starting to slip at school. And she only had a few months to go before graduation, but she found out at that point that she was going to have to retake a class. So things were falling apart, and Kathy didn't know what to do. Well, on January 31st, 1982, Kathy and Robert had been fighting all day long. She left their home in South Salem to drive to her friend Gilberta's house in Connecticut for a party. Now, Gilberta was catering this event and it was a big party, but Kathy was not expected to show up. But when she did show up, she was dressed in sweats. Her hair was disheveled. She was not the put-together woman that they usually saw in public. You could tell whatever was going on, it was rough. Well, she got there. She told Gilberta that she and Robert had been fighting all day and that she just had to get away from him for a while. Well, she had several glasses of wine. She did some cocaine with the other people at the party. And at this point, she was feeling really good. And according to most of the party guests, telling everyone how horrible Robert was. All the things he'd done to her, how he wouldn't pay for anything, how abusive he was. Just basically spewing everywhere how miserable she was. She was at her wit's end. Robert had pushed her to the brink. Well, to top things off, several of the guests told police later on that Robert had called throughout the evening demanding that Kathy come home, come home, come home, come home. Because, of course, he wanted her there. He wanted to control her. Well, she was frustrated. She was sick of him. She was done, but she was also done with all the phone calls. So finally, out of frustration, she was like, "Fine, I'm coming home." Now, this is not an easy drive. It's dark. It's snowy. It's mountainous roads. She's pissed off. And now at this point, under the influence of alcohol and drugs, this is not an easy drive, and she should not be making it. She goes out onto the porch with her friend Gilberta. Gilberta's like, "You know, stay. Don't go home." Kathy's like, "No, I'm going home. I'm going to have it out with Robert tonight. I'm telling him that's it. I'm done." So Gilberta's like, "Yes, you do it. Tell him this is it. You want a divorce. Get out. Leave him." So she pumps up Kathy, and Kathy's like, "Yes, I'm going home to end things." But then she turns around and she tells Gilberta, "I'm scared of Robert." And if something happens to me, check Robert out and suspect foul play. I'm scared of him and I don't know what he's going to do. Kathy Durst got in her car and drove off into the night. It was the last time anyone would ever see Kathy alive. Thank you for listening to tonight's episode. I will have the next one out to you shortly so you can hear what happens next. It's a crazy roller coaster, like I said, and I'd love to hear what you guys think so far, or if you're familiar with the whole Robert Durst case, if you watch the Jinx, it's nuts. Tell me what you think. Chime in. I'd love to hear from you. You can find me on Instagram at Texas True Crime Pod. You can find me on Facebook at Texas True Crime. You can send me an email at TexasTrueCrimePodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening tonight, and I will have the next episode out to you very, very soon. Thanks, and I'll see you next time. Bye.